Good evening. Welcome to Kick the Puppy. This is episode 17, the first episode of 2019. We're recording this on January the 6th. I'm Keith Preston, and with me as always is RJ. And into the news for 2019, there was an interesting article in The Observer about corrupt public officials and all of the things that they have bought with taxpayer money this year. And some of this is entertaining. Let's see, just to give some examples, there's some well-known figures that are mentioned here, but Scott Pruitt, who is the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency, let's see, apparently he spent over $130,000 on personal travel during his 18-month tenure as an EPA administrator. This includes employing private planes and military jets for air transportation, but for personal use, not as part of his professional responsibilities. Apparently, he had a soundproof booth installed in his office for $43,000.
Straight up fraud.
Well, the interesting thing about him, the most interesting thing, is he actually managed to spend $1,560 on a 12-pack of pens sporting his signature and the EPA seal.
Wow.
And he had lived for 6 months in a Capitol Hill condo owned by a healthcare lobbyist whose husband lobbied for the EPA, regularly sent his staff out on personal errands. So, yeah, I mean, he pretty much just turned the Environmental Protection Agency.
He bought his wife a Chick-fil-A franchise.
Yeah, I saw that one, too. He called it a franchise of faith, yes.
Yeah,
he enlisted his aide for a number of personal tasks. Well, no, let's see. He bought his wife a Chick-fil-A franchise with public money. Wow.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing you see in some of the most retrograde nations, like in the underdeveloped world, you know, like in Africa, Latin America, somewhere like that, South Asia. Let's see, Megan Barry, who was the mayor of Nashville, she was caught having an extramarital affair. That's nothing unique. The guy she was having an affair with was a police officer who was head of her security detail. But apparently they used public money to travel a lot, to go to late night concerts, yoga classes, trips out of the United States. And they would claim all of this was overtime pay for her bodyguard / lover. And apparently, let's see, there was one trip where they went to Greece at the cost of tens of thousands of dollars in public money. And eventually she, apparently she was busted for felony theft. She's since agreed to serve 3 years probation and reimburse the city $11,000 for unlawful expenditures. And then her friend, her lover, bodyguard, police sergeant guy, let's see, he was ordered to return $45,000. He was wrongly paid during instances when he was not performing his duty. All right.
Yeah, it's a little slap on the wrist.
Let's see, Ben Carson, of course, he was one of the presidential candidates in 2016 initially. He's well known for being a neurosurgeon. Apparently, at one point, he separated some co-joint tens or something like that. That was his big professional accomplishments. But now he's the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Oh, he used department funds to purchase a new mahogany dining room set worth $31,000. All right. The set, which included a custom hardwood table, chairs, and a hutch, was purchased shortly after Carson's wife was exposed for pressuring HUD officials to scrape money together through illegal or illegal means to complete an extensive redecoration of his offices. He later defended the purchase in front of a House Appropriations Committee, claiming the previous table was actually dangerous for anyone who used it. Wow.
Yeah, his lawyer probably told him, yeah, just tell him it was dangerous. We had to get a new one.
You know, they were worried his cocktails would get knocked off the table or something.
Right.
Let's see. Ryan Zink, the Interior Secretary, he was caught spending an impossible $139,000 on new doors for his office suite. How can doors cost $139,000?
They don't.
I mean, I guess if the doors are made out of gold or have gold frames or something, maybe. I mean,
or maybe your buddy owns the door company and you're just stealing a lot of money together.
Right, exactly. That would be like if you had a friend that, you know, owned a construction company or a home improvement company or home remodeling company. Just say, hey, you know, come and put some new doors in. It has $139,000. said he once spent $6,250 on a helicopter flight to meet Vice President Mike Pence for a horseback ride. So I guess he chartered a private helicopter. That's what that sounds like. And he probably pocketed a lot of the money. I mean, they probably, you know, write this off as an expense. Well, I need new doors, $139,000, of which, you know, $129,000 goes in their pocket.
Yeah.
California Congressman Duncan Hunter. Let's see.
Duncan Hunter, that's the guy who smokes his vapor in Congress.
Right, yeah.
That's Duncan Hunter Jr. Duncan Hunter Jr. slid into office right as his dad, Duncan Hunter Sr., slid out. I don't think the voters even noticed.
Because I think they just use the same name. I don't think the son uses the junior suffix. I think he...
Yeah.
But anyway, it says he was indicted along with his wife in August for allegedly using $250,000 in campaign funds for a myriad of personal expenses. The Hunters are said to have dropped $704 of taxpayer money on tickets for the play How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Can't say much for his taste in entertainment. $700 to pay down their family's overdue balance at a dental practice. $14,000 on a family vacation. $1,000 more to fly his wife's mother and her boyfriend to Poland. Spent tens of thousands of dollars on smaller items, like $462 on 30 shots of tequila and a steak dinner. Well, at least that went to good use. $300 shopping spree at Target. Getting in touch with the working people, I guess. $200 on running shoes. Wow.
Yeah, these people make me sick.
$250 to fly, $250 to fly the family's pet rabbit to D.C. Chris Christie Cream.
He's a slob.
Fat slob from New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he paid $85,000 in government funds for an official portrait. Oh, man. That's narcissistic personality.
That's hilarious. Well, yeah, Obama did stuff like that, though, too. Obama put his face on a basketball. Didn't he write, like, 3 autobiographies?
Yeah, I think so.
Who writes 3 autobiographies? Who needs 3 autobiographies?
Yeah, I mean, they were all written within a relatively short period of time, within, you know, 10 years of each other or something.
Yeah.
Greg Fisher, he's the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky. He used $109,000 in taxpayer money to entertain a group of secret guests during the mayoral race in May. Deployed government funds to cover everything from $72,000 in tickets to Churchill Downs. That's a horse racing franchise. And nearly $30,000 on rooms at the Omni Hotel in downtown Louisville to $300 on customized magnetic name tags, and $213 worth of umbrellas and plastic bags from Dollar Tree. So he's got his cheap umbrellas from Dollar Tree, then he's got his $300 magnetic name tags.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's interesting. Of course, these are just a drop in the bucket. I mean, you know, probably the majority of public officials have something like this in their background if you really dig hard enough.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine, you know, I mean, really, what's the point in being a politician? I mean, there are some people who may have, you know, ideologies or ideals or something they want to advance, but I'm sure for most politicians, this is what it's about. It's a career. Yeah. And of course, they're only talking about personal corruption here. They're not going into institutional corruption, like the huge sums of money, you know, millions, tons of millions, billions of dollars that are received in things like corporate welfare and bank welfare and all that kind of stuff. You know, so I mean, this is just individual personal corruption here. Well, speaking of government ripoffs, apparently the IRS plans to take taxpayer money but not issue refunds during the shutdown. So the government is supposedly shut down because Donald Trump can't have his wall around the Mexican border, or the Democrats won't give him money for it, or whatever the issue is. So the IRS, of course, is still saying you have to pay taxes, but they're not going to issue the refunds during the shutdown. So somebody was actually telling me that the problem is that the refunds are actually processed by temp workers that are hired by the IRS. So they don't have the IRS supposedly doesn't have the funds to hire these temp workers that are going to issue tax refunds.
Yeah, but it sounds like the machine is still running.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they're still collecting money. Yeah. That's not a problem.
It's almost as if the government goes out of its way to make things as difficult as possible just to kind of make sure that we get the message that we need the government in our lives. Like, they do things like when you look at the websites, government websites that shut down, they're not really shut down to where, you know, they'd actually be saving money because everything is truly shut down. They're not even turning off their servers. They just put up like a sorry, the government's shut down type of message, which means they're still using power. They're still using bandwidth. The federal government servers are still running. Somebody had to work in order to change the websites and update their systems and put up all those messages. You know, but you know, they're not going to answer phone. The government is supposedly shut down. It's just so stupid.
Speaking of that, apparently the TSA screeners are now working without pay, so they started to call in sick at major airports. Who cares? I mean, we're one for Trump on that one.
Yeah, you know, I'm normally very pro-worker. I mean, the political issue that matters to me the most personally is the worker. Like, if you work a full-time job, you should be able to make a living for yourself. If you can't, something's wrong. And, you know, because of this, I tend to have sympathy for the worker. But I also hate the government for personal reasons. So when it comes to cops, you know, TSA people, like, I get it. You know, these TSA guys working without pay, some of them have families and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, you know, you chose to work for the government. I don't feel sorry for you. I think that some jobs make the world a shittier place, like telemarketers. You know, if you sit on your ass all day blowing up people's phones with some annoying ass shit that nobody wants anything to do with, I can't feel sorry for you. TSA, it's the same thing. It's just one of those jobs I have no sympathy for.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing about that is I used to be a telemarketer years ago, like 30 years ago. And now when telemarketers call me, I'm rude as hell because I know what a scam it is.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you're doing exactly what I used to do. I know what I used to do. So, another former follower of Charles Manson was granted parole. This guy's actually pretty interesting, Bobby Boussoulet. He was a musician before he hooked up with Manson, and he actually was in a band called Love. It was a fairly well-known group in the California area in the mid-60s. There was a guy named Arthur Lee who was the leader of this group. They had a song called Seven and Seven Is, which is like a fairly big hit from that time period. And he was also associated with the filmmaker Kenneth Anger. And he, while he was in prison, he actually scored the soundtrack for this film that Kenneth Anger wrote called Lucifer Rising. And that soundtrack is actually available online. It's actually pretty interesting, pretty kind of weird, trippy music. But this guy at some point got involved with Charles Manson, and he ended up killing this guy in what was either a robbery gone bad or a drug deal gone bad or something like that. It wasn't the Sharon Tate murders. It was another murder that happened before that. So, of course, this guy's now been in prison for about 50 years. He was 21 when he did the crime. He's 71 now.
Oh, wow.
And he was originally sentenced to death. But when the Supreme Court overturned, or the California Supreme Court overturned death sentences in the early 70s, his sentence was commuted to life. He was finally approved for parole after 18 turndowns. What's going to be interesting about this, though, is that a couple other of these Manson people have been approved for parole, but in California, the governor has to approve all rules. And Bruce Davis, who was another Manson guy, he was approved for parole. I think he's been approved like 3 or 4 times. And then he got approved, and Arnold Schwarzenegger turned down his bid for parole. And then Jerry Brown came in as governor of California, and he turned down the guy's bid for parole, I think twice, maybe 3 times. But interestingly, though, Jerry Brown is now leaving office. This new guy, Gavin Newsom, who used to be the mayor of San Francisco, he's coming in. He's known for being somewhat liberal, so maybe he will finally approve some of these people's parole. Like Leslie Van Houten was actually approved for parole, too, at one point. And she was her parole was turned down. She was approved by the parole board, but her parole was turned down by Jerry Brown. In England, a fellow was arrested for testing positive for every possible detectable drug. That's actually not that unusual. I know people personally that I'm pretty sure if they got arrested for DWI or something, they'd probably test positive for every possible detectable drug.
Yeah.
I mean, what do they test you for? I mean, I've never had a drug test like this, but they test you for,
I think it's like a 7-panel test. So.
It's like marijuana, heroin, cocaine, meth, you know.
Barbiturates. Which would be like shrooms. He definitely got the rectal probe.
Talking about someone that's out of his mind in Florida, weird stuff like this always happens in Florida. There was a Florida guy who was worried about vampires, so he burned down his own house, I guess, to get rid of the vampires. So this says one of two things, either some serious drugs or a genuine mental illness like schizophrenia, something like that.
Yeah, possibly schizophrenia or smoking bath salts. Yeah, Florida man is something else. I mean, the most unbelievable news that comes out tends to have a headline that begins with Florida man. Florida man does this. Florida man does. Texas man is also a hard act to follow. California man is definitely up there too, but Florida man is something else.
In the social sciences, for example, in criminology, one of the things that we have discovered is that violence tends to happen at a higher rate in warm climates as opposed to cold climates.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at all the different countries around the world, it's the warmest countries where there tends to be the highest rate of violence. In terms of crime and war and stuff like that, like Africa, for example, as opposed to Scandinavia, or, Mexico as opposed to Canada. And even in the United States, it's actually in the southern states, or in Southern California or Texas, or Florida. It's all those places that have the highest rates of violent crime and just the weirdest crime.
Yeah, well, and also a lot of these drugs burn your body up, like smoking bath salts. That's why you'll see a guy who was smoking bath salts who did something like tried to eat a guy where he was found naked. You know, he was burning up. He took his clothes off. A lot of bad dope, like bad methamphetamine, makes you overheat as well.
So is that what causes that? The body actually heats up or something and
yeah, your body heats up. And then if you're also in a, like you're saying, a warmer climate, it's like, yeah, when everybody's hot and everybody's frustrated, yeah, more people kill people.
Well, murder rates go up in the summer, too.
Yeah.
And during the summer, murder rates tend to be higher than in the winter.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking about Florida man, now Florida woman. Florida woman attacks her parents after they refuse to take her to Outback Steakhouse.
Wow.
This is a 28-year-old woman.
So. Yeah, what a brat.
Maybe there's some mental illness there too as well.
Yeah, I've dated girls like that. Yeah.
Me too. See, an entrepreneurial guy here. Apparently there was a guy that makes pipe guns from scrap metal and sells them to gun buyback programs. That's actually a pretty good plan. Make your own guns and then sell them to these gun buyback programs. Apparently he gets $300 each for them. Is it illegal to make your own guns with scrap metal?
It
seemed like it would be. I mean, because guns typically have to be licensed, you know. I mean, well, they have to have a serial number and all that kind of stuff, you know. A lot of people think guns are not regulated in the United States, but they are. I mean, they're not as regulated as much as they are some countries, but they're still regulated. I mean, you can't have a lot of different types of weapons, and they're supposed to have identification, like a serial number and things like that. So it seems like you're just making guns.
And then selling them to the government. I mean, you got to be careful with the ATF. A friend of mine, his dad, back in the 80s, I think it was, he was robbing storage units. And he robbed a storage unit that had like 300 and some guns. And he couldn't sell them because he had all these guns. And anyway, he ended up getting raided by ATF, and he did like 20 years for this. And when ATF raided him, they went in wearing skeleton masks.
Yeah, well, I mean, ATF, they're the ones that carried out the massacre in Waco back in 1993, 26 years ago. They rolled in a tank and killed the whole compound full of people, like over 100 people.
Yeah, so they're into that shit. They come in hard. They put the gun in your mouth, make it hurt, all that.
Yeah, the thing is, though, it seems like these gun buyback programs would be a waste of time. I mean, somebody that actually wants to commit a violent crime with a gun, I mean, they're not going to go sell their gun. You know, I mean, they're probably not going to have a legal gun to start with.
Right.
So, interesting article from Geopolitics Alert. Geopolitics Alert, I would highly recommend. It's a commentary site on international relations. And it talks about what has happened in Yemen in 2018. Apparently there have been over 52,000 attacks on Yemen and 50 airstrikes per day on average. Wow. So these are people that know what it means to be oppressed.
Yeah, that's a lot of war.
I mean, imagine if you lived in a society where there's 52,000 air attacks. I mean, that's roughly one a week. That's 1,000 a week. So that's like, what, about 150 air attacks a day?
Yeah, and all the little war babies that grow up with a lot of resentment too.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're a kid in a society like that, that's normal. That's just life. You know, that's just how you do things.
Yeah.
Some interesting scientific news. China lands spacecraft on the moon. I haven't heard much about this in the American press. This was actually a pretty landmark thing here. The Chinese have this Land Rover, Space Rover, or whatever it's called, but they've actually landed this on the darker side of the moon, and it's just a scientific vehicle or piece of technology or whatever. But it's historically unprecedented, somewhat unique, but I haven't heard the American media talk about it much. Probably because they're embarrassed that the Chinese are outpacing them now.
Yeah, I read about that. You know, what's interesting about it is the origins of the name for this spacecraft. There was this good-looking Chinese chick, Chang'e. According to the legend, she's been living on the moon for 4,000 years. And she was sent there because she stole this pill of immortality from her husband. And so she's the only person who is going to live forever. And so they punished her by sending her to the moon to live forever alone. Well, not alone. There's supposed to be a big rabbit, supposedly like this big rabbit character who's supposed to be her partner in crime there or something like this. And so that's why they named one of the Chinese rovers on the moon, they named it Jade Rabbit. So they have like this whole moon rabbit folklore thing going on, and they chose the name for a reason, and I thought that was kind of interesting. I think they believe in something with the moon having to do with moon rice too or something like
that. Yeah, I had heard the name had something to do with a moon goddess or something like that. But the Chinese are really moving along when it comes to technology. Like, they have these really high-speed trains and things like that, you know, stuff that we don't have here. So they definitely are into the technology.
Yeah.
We've been talking about the cost of living in a lot of different cities. Apparently, cost of living has risen faster in Seattle than in any other city. What's interesting is how it's all these supposedly progressive cities where it's so expensive to live, you know, like Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. I guess it's in part because there's a lot of people that want to live there, so there's a high demand for services, and that raises prices. Some of these places, they regulate housing markets to death that have the effect of constricting the supply of housing, so that causes a lot of housing to become more expensive than it otherwise would be. I've never actually been to Seattle, though. I don't think it's somewhere I really want to go. From what I hear, it's very overcast most of the time. I used to have a friend of mine from there. In fact, I knew this guy years ago when I was in the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies. He had grown up in Seattle in the 1950s, and he was talking about how it was very overcast, and that's the kind of weather he liked. He actually liked overcast weather.
It sounds like a place where the elites would like to live, and that's why, if anything, tech money will move there, but then eventually you'll have high cost of living and things will look more like San Francisco. If they could get the tech money to Detroit, it would actually help Detroit with that sort of development. Like, of course, the elites aren't going to want to live in a place like Detroit. You know, the thing with San Francisco, I don't know what's going on with this whole Seattleization. Like, I don't know what's actually causing what these people are talking about. But I do know in San Francisco, it's a combination of things like not having the transportation systems that they need, and then not being able to build multifamily in certain areas. And then in other areas, they can. You know, like if you talk to an insurance agent or someone who's knows a lot about real estate out in California, they'll tell you about how, like, in the South Bay, which is Silicon Valley, you'll have, like, the cost is like 700 to 1,000 square foot to build. But that's also almost the same to rent. And so nobody's building. So you have to go to the next town where they are building. Even a lot of the tech people who actually work in these fields are like living on the BART or the Caltrain because they can't even afford to live in San Francisco. So they're living like somewhere in Stockton or something like this. So, you know, even some of the people who are going into the tech industry are actually being victimized by this. I don't know what's going on with Seattle, but they mentioned that tech money is moving there. And if tech money is moving there, that's probably has something to do with it.
Yeah, well, I've heard that. I've heard a lot of big tech money is moving into Seattle. But interestingly, though, it's a very left-leaning city. Like one of their city council people is actually a Trotskyite. She's from the Socialist Alternative, or one of those groups. So, although there seems to be an overlap though, between far left and the tech industry, though, so it's interesting.
Yeah, but it's most of the people I know who work in the tech industry, they like to sort of pretend to be left-leaning at some kind of cultural level. But then really they turn out to be very classist. They'll do things like say, hey, you know, we need affordable housing. But then they'll actually vote against affordable housing because they don't want something that looks too ghetto popping up across the street. So it's like.
Right. Yeah. So they're more like hipsters.
Yeah.
An astronaut accidentally called 9/11 from space. This was in Newsweek. Well, I mean, things happened.
It's kind of funny that you have to dial 9 to get an outside line from space.
Well, that was that used to be normal back in the old days. Like when I was younger, to make a long distance phone call from a lot of offices, you had to dial 9 first. This was back before we had all of the easy calling we have now. A lot of people today who are younger or who just don't remember how difficult telephone communication used to be. Like it used to be. The way that the telephone services were is you just had local calling. You could just call within your city or county or something like that. And if you wanted to call to the next county over, the next city over, you had to pay a lot of money for long distance calling, and it could get really expensive. And then a lot of times to call to another jurisdiction, you have to dial 9 first. Certainly if you were on some kind of multi-calling system, like in an office building or something like that.
Yeah, like a network. They still have that in hotels and hospitals, you know, work buildings. You still have to, anything where there's an internal switchboard and a PBX person, you have to dial 9. But this is from space. I guess NASA is really no different than any other network. But what I don't understand is that if the outside lines are in Houston, they said they had to call, they were calling Houston, why do you have to dial the international access code 011 to call Houston? You'd think that, you know, NASA would have its own country code. Unless the article made a mistake, maybe they weren't actually calling a Houston number. Maybe they're just through Houston. Maybe it's like Houston, you know, Houston would have a problem. Maybe that's just the code name.
But I wonder how the dispatchers took it when they got a call from space.
Yeah.
Sorry, we don't go that far.
Yeah.
The Washington Post. Living paycheck to paycheck is disturbingly common. Yeah, what else is new? Nothing like stating the obvious.
But I mean, if real estate agents and business executives and computer programmers and people like that, if they're living paycheck to paycheck, there might be something wrong with them. You know, that might be like more of a mental problem. Like if it gets to a point where no matter how much money you're making, you're always on the treadmill, then something could just be wrong with you. You know, it's like, that's like nothing could be enough type of thing. That's like, you know, you'll still find a way to go broke just to keep up with the socioeconomic rat race. Like something's wrong there.
Yeah, well, I actually saw an article about that a while back. I don't remember the source, but they were talking about how high-income people have problems paying their bills, and they were talking about all these cases of doctors and lawyers and business executives, you know, well-paid, high-income professional people that are, you know, have six-figure incomes, and they were living paycheck to paycheck because they incurred so many expenses, you know. I mean, for one thing, you have a lot of those kinds of jobs. You have to have advanced education, so they've got these huge student loan payments as part of it. And then if they live in large cities, they've got big rent payments and stuff like that. We was talking about how people who are in that position, they try to, you know, put on the appearance and live the life of somebody that's of that class position, and that they, you know, they try to live like they're expected to live. You know, so you have these people that are, professional people, and they get the most expensive house they can get, you know, within, you know, their range and beyond. So they have huge house payments, and then they get the most expensive cars they can get, and, you know, they get their membership in the country club or whatever it is they think they're supposed to belong to. And of course they've got to wear the most expensive clothes. But it was an article about how you've got people that are making, you know, $150,000 a year or $200,000 a year and live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, they're still living like rats in big cities.
Yeah, so, you know, even if their personal income, you know, disposable income is $15,000 a month or something, they're still living paycheck to paycheck because they get $15,000 a month in expenditures. I mean, I know people like that myself. You know, I know people who have incomes on that level, and that's what they do. I mean, you know, their personal income is, you know, after taxes is, you know, say $150,000 a year. And so that's what, you know, a little less than $10,000, something like that, or, you know, $10,000-$15,000 a month that they're supposedly have to spend, but they never save a dime of it. You know, I mean, they've got to, you know, a car and or two cars or three cars, or they've got a huge house payment or huge rents. You know, I mean, they're living in a place that's like $2,500 a month, you know, as opposed to say $1,500. There was a Chinese scientist who claimed to make genetically edited babies. Now he's being kept under guard. So maybe he spilled the beans and talked a little too much.
This story is getting more and more... Okay, first of all, this guy's name is He. It's Dr. He.
Right.
And there are a representative from the hospital that supposedly approved his study or his project, what he's doing, is now denying that the gene editing process took place at their hospital. So that means it looks like the babies, the first gene-edited babies weren't born there. So we don't really know where the first gene-edited babies were born at this point. Now, the Chinese government, they probably know. It looks like the government has actually had him on some sort of house arrest, his family too. I guess he went missing. He was supposed to show up at some conference, which he didn't show up to. He went missing, and they started writing about him. Now we're finding out that he's on lockdown at some dorm at his university, and this is all according to the New York Times. And the only thing they've really been able to – the New York Times doesn't really know what's going on. The only thing they've been able to really confirm is that when they went to get a hold of this guy, they had security guys blocking access to where he usually does his work. So his former offices are all blocked off. They can't get in. But his name and his biography are still on the board listing for the staff members of the university's biology department. So this guy's still got a job. Just to be clear, it's not that this guy was using CRISPR that made this a huge deal. What happened is the couple that gave consent to him to do what he's doing, he didn't really tell them everything. They thought that these babies were going to get some sort of vaccination. When really, this Dr. He guy, he's definitely shady. He ended up making a mutation that was supposed to make these babies completely immune to HIV. But what actually happened was the mutation is, number one, it made them immune to like a few HIV strains, not all of them. So they're not like immune to HIV. And then also, they're more prone to other diseases now, like the West Nile virus infection. So he's responsible for this mutation now. He knowingly found a way around the proper official scientific approval process. So this guy's being seen as a sort of a scumbag by regular people, and then he's being seen as kind of a rogue actor by the Chinese state. You know, he's working with CRISPR, and he's doing, you know, the Chinese government probably wants to know everything this guy was doing. If I was China, I'd lock this guy in an underground work lab and just make him work 8 days a week.
Yeah, well, I would imagine that China will probably be ahead of the game in the future as far as genetic experimentation and things like that, because they don't really seem to have many qualms about that. Like, you know, they've already had the one-child policy and stuff like that, which in the West would be considered a violation of individual rights or human rights and things like that. And, of course, eugenics and all that kind of stuff has a bad name in the West because of the legacy of Nazi Germany and things that was used for in the past. But the Chinese, I doubt, have many qualms about that. They don't seem to. I mean, they're big on organ harvesting and all that kind of stuff as well. So I imagine it's probably going to be China that's in the front of the takes the lead in terms of genetic experimentation and all of these kinds of things, genetically engineered babies and people and all this kind of stuff in the future.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's an interesting article from Australia. The new wave of sobriety startups is shaking up the 12-step model. I used to work in a psychiatric hospital years ago, and because when I was in my first round of graduate school, I was a psych major at one point. I mean, not my first round of undergrad, first round of college. So for a time, I worked in a psychiatric hospital when I was assigned to the substance abuse wing. And I always thought that the 12-step model was a bit limited. In fact, I thought a lot of the stuff, now this was a long time ago, this was in the early 90s, but I used to think a lot of the official dogma in that field of substance abuse treatment was a bit off the mark. Like, I never really agreed with the concept of what they call disease concept, which is like the idea of, oh, substance abuse is a disease or something like that. And then they would, you know, say, well, the 12-step program is the treatment. But I used to think, well, that's not treatment. You know, that's just a, you know, that's just something you do as a matter of routine or something like that. And it can help. I mean, it can be helpful for some people, because it gives people a type of structure or organization to their life that they might not otherwise have. In fact, I used to see people get addicted to the 12-step program. You know, I used to be in a band with a guy when I was in my mid-20s that was a ex-cokehead, and he had already been clean for something like 7 years, and he still talked this, you know, 12-step rehab stuff 24/7. I mean, it was like his religion or something. But from what I have heard, they've actually started moving away from some of these kinds of things in the substance abuse treatment field. Now they started to use other, you know, more conventional or more contemporary therapeutic models.
Well, they need to. You know, I've spent a lot of time around AA and NA people as well. I've actually been to hundreds of meetings, dude. One of the first problems is that, you know, is the involvement with the criminal justice system. But it's very closely tied to the criminal justice system. So you go to a meeting, and a lot of the people who are in those meetings are forced to be there as part of the sentencing. So it's not like they're even really interested in that program. One of their traditions is, you know, we're a program that is based on attraction and not promotion. That's not really true. I mean, you'll be in a meeting where a whole minute of silence goes by, nobody's talking, and then someone will finally be like, oh, fine, I'll share. Nobody even wants to be there. That's problem number one. Number two, the whole God thing is ridiculous. Like, basically, you have to believe in God or you can't get off drugs. That's what they tell you. I've seen guys pick up a rock on the ground and say, look, you see this rock? This rock is your higher power. Just take this rock. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm not going to go along with this. And then also, the program reinforces the moral failure stigma, where it's like, you know, they tell you to take a fearless moral inventory of yourself. And, you know, that's all bullshit. So it has nothing to do with moral failure. You know, you don't gamble yourself broke and go into debt with the mafia because you're a bad person. You don't shoot dope in a room full of strangers because you're a bad person. You know, I think it has more to do with genetic and environmental factors. There's a lot going on there, but it has nothing to do with moral failing. It's just stupid. Like you said, it works for some people, but then there's a lot of people who it just doesn't work for at all.
When I was around that field, back then it tended to be very new agey. It had this kind of, like you were saying, this almost quasi-religious dimension to it, but it was sort of like semi-Christian on one hand and semi kind of New Agey, kind of mystical on the other hand, because that kind of stuff was around back then, though, the New Agey kind of pop culture, you know, psychobabble stuff, this kind of, you know, pop culture spirituality and all that.
Well, it's still like that, because the AA program, you know, in the early 1900s, it was created for people who were culturally Christian. It still has the same backbone, but what they've done is they've tried to become more open-minded. They've tried to, you know, instead of saying God, you know, say a higher power. You know, and your higher power could be anything, but it has the same underlying philosophical foundation. And that's why you have, for instance, you know, the moral failure stigma that's attached to it. And a lot of the spiritual principles are still the same. So yeah, you're right. It's kind of like, you know, it's like this quasi-Christian, let's try to mix in something new for people who are looking for some sort of open-mindedness. But at the end of the day, it's the same bullshit.
Well, there's actually a group called SOS, or there used to be. It was called the Yes, well, this one was called Secular Organization for Sobriety. But it's basically like AA or NA. It's the 12-step program, only it's secular. They don't have all the God stuff in it, you know, the kind of religious stuff in it. But it's still the same concept, though.
Yeah, there's a group here in Vegas called SOS, but that's Survivors of Suicide, and it's mostly families. But families of victims of suicide.
Yeah, it's never seemed to me that those programs worked very well at all. In fact, if anything, it was the opposite. I used to know a lot of drug addicts. That's where they meet their friends they do drugs with. It's at 12-step programs.
Yeah, but it works for some people, and so more power to the people who it does work for. But it is good to see that they are starting to open up new roads to recovery for people.
Well, on that note, I guess that will be it for this evening. I've been going for a while. So, for episode 17 of Kick the Puppy, this is Keith with RJ, first podcast of 2019, January 6th, 2019. Until next time.